From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
You know, that's a very interesting story to me because there I was in Longview, Texas, trying to get blacks registered to vote and everything, and especially getting close to when my husband died. There was just so many things to be done, like in 1964 when you had the Accommodation Act, and I had to test it in Longview. Couldn't get anybody to go with me to any restaurant to test it. It just so happened that there was a fellow from Longview who came. He was a principal somewhere, and he and his wife would come visit his mother. So she didn't mind going with me, you know, because she felt the same way I did about things. So anyway, I worked real hard with those Democratic fellows, white fellows, you know, trying to raise the percentage of blacks and all of that. And it came time where I could possibly think about law school.
The Honorable Dr. Harriet N. Murphy, retired municipal court judge, civil rights activist, former college professor and department head, and author of There Are the Honor Lines, a memoir published by University of Texas Press. As the only African-American female in her UT Austin law class, Murphy has long been a champion of diversity issues. As a young girl growing up in the Buckhead section of Atlanta, Georgia, she recognized early on that fighting injustice and inequality would be her life calling. Through her work with the NAACP and the National Urban League, she sought social change at the state and local level. In 1969, Murphy was the only African-American student to graduate from the University of Texas School of Law. And in 1973, she was the first African-American female to be appointed to a judgeship in the Lone Star State. Also, Murphy was instrumental in getting new legislation passed, capping the 10% rule at 75%. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, There Are the Honor Lines, a memoir with the Honorable Dr. Harriet M. Murphy, In Black America.
Buckhead in Atlanta was kind of like Tarrytown, where all the rich and affluent whites lived at that time. But there were several black pockets like Clarksville was here throughout Buckhead. And I ended up and living in probably about two or three of those places in Buckhead. And of course, I lived in Bagley Park longer than any others. The first one was Willistown, which was on Dunwoody Road. And strangely enough, in those days, Dunwoody Road was a paved road. I didn't know of any black community out there in Buckhead that even had a paved road. And it was named Willistown because my great-grandmother, who was born in slavery, was freed when she was 6 years old. And, of course, her name was Harriet, and I'm named after her. She started building in that little area, and I think there were about four or five other houses there. And that's where I spent my real early childhood.
As a young child growing up in segregated Atlanta, Georgia in the 1930s and 40s, Judge Harriet M. Murphy had it better than most. That is, she lived on a street that was paved. She attended a one-room schoolhouse in Fulton County. Murphy graduated seventh grade at valedictorian. That put her on the academic track for those students who were college-bound. While attending Booker T. Washington High School, she had the opportunity to interview the first African-American to earn a Ph.D. from Harvard, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, for her English class. Of course, she didn't take the assignment seriously. She embarrassed herself. But that encounter with him changed the way Murphy looked at the African-American experience in this country. Murphy went on to attend Spelman College. She earned a master's degree from Atlanta University. She became a public school teacher in Georgia. She taught government at Prairie View A&M University. And in 1966, she entered the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. Recently, In Black America spoke with the Honorable Harriet M. Murphy.
I was telling a very good friend of mine one of these stories that was in there, and she said, you need to write a book. So that was some years ago, so I thought about it for a while, and then later, I said, I think I will write a book, because I had been writing letters to the editor and op-eds in the paper. And I said, I think I need to go ahead on and write a book, you know, about my memoirs.
Tell our audience about your early days growing up in Atlanta. Was that Buckhead?
Yes. Okay. Buckhead in Atlanta was kind of like Tarrytown, where all the rich and affluent whites lived at that time. But there were several black pockets, like Clarksville was here throughout Buckhead. And I ended up in living in probably about two or three of those places in Buckhead. And of course, I lived in Bagley Park longer than any others. The first one was Willistown, which was on Dunwoody Road. And strangely enough, in those days, Dunwoody Road was a paved road. I didn't know of any black community out there in Buckhead that even had a paved road. And it was named Willistown because my great-grandmother, who was born in slavery, was freed when she was 6 years old. And of course, her name was Harriet, and I'm named after her. She started building in that little area. And I think there were about four or five other houses there. And that's where I spent my real early childhood, in Buckhead at Willistown.
Tell us about the time that your granddad wanted you to start calling him Dad.
Yes, my grandfather was kind of a popular minister, preacher, and my mother's mother was his first wife. She died. Mm-hmm. And then he married a very young woman, beautiful young woman, and he had two children by her. And then he got a divorce from her, and he married the wife he lived with until he died. But he was kind of like president of that circuit or something, and he was always traveling, and all the women knew him and everything. So he didn't want to be called Granddaddy. Mm-hmm. He said, why don't you just call me Daddy? And that's what I did.
Tell us about the time when you were in high school.
In high school is where I really messed up on my age, but I didn't.
I'm not sure
whether it. I was able to become a member of a clique, and it was kind of a popular elite clique. And the reason was that there was a fellow named John George Funderburg from American Georgia, who father didn't think the schools were good enough in America's Georgia because he was a doctor and everything. So he sent George up to live in Atlanta. And of course, he had to attend Booker T. Washington High School because that was the only school that blacks could go to after they closed down the one at Spelman. And of course, all the girls, you know, just thought he was heaven. And we would stand in the hall just to watch him pass. Mm-hmm. So by living in Buckhead, there was a young lady who did go to Spelman. She even went to high school at Spelman. She had an aunt living, even though this was really in a ghetto. This aunt had a beautiful home there. Mm-hmm. And Evelyn would come out to visit her sometimes. And she was dating a fella, last name Cunningham. So one evening, she and Cunningham and George came to visit her aunt, and there was something going on at the USO, which was right behind our school. So they wanted to know if I could go with them. So I said, yes. You know, I want to say yes, 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 yes. So they asked my mother, and she said that I could go. So we went, and we danced, and we had a lovely time, except I had to fight him all the way there and all the way back. But the next day when I went to school, all of a sudden I was so popular. That these girls wanted me to join their clique, you know. And they were rather fast. And it was there that I messed up on my age because I was only 14. And,
really?
And they were 16. Mm-hmm. And I had not turned in a birth certificate. So the principal called me one day and told me he didn't have a birth certificate for me. Now, I didn't know how old I was, but I did know the day, the 6th of June, because my mother always had me a little birthday party. I remember the date. But I wanted to be the same age that they were. So I just assumed maybe I'm 16, too. So anyway, I went and got my own birth certificate and signed up that I was 16. And that has just gone on for years. It was only when the 1940 census came out that they had my real age in there, which meant I was 2 years younger than I've been telling people all these years. And it was all because they invited me to become a part of their clique. And I just thought, you know, this poor girl coming out of Buckhead could run around with these real smart and from middle class. They were middle class black girls, kids. And I felt that, you know, that I was just lucky.
I know, that's right. In high school, that's when you first met Martin Luther King Jr.? All called him ML?
Yeah, he was, I guess he was writing for the school paper. And, you know, I didn't really associate with him. It was just passing him in the hall. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that we both were. They had three categories of in that system at that high school. It was the only high school for blacks in Atlanta at that time. So they had the academic, those on the academic track, those on the commercial track, and those in distributive education where they would teach the fellows how to put gas in cars and things like that. But ML and I, we were both in the academic track, and sometimes that would be something going on. And I mean, I didn't think of him as being important or anything. He was just there as a student until I read what he wrote in the 1944 yearbook, you know.
Tell us about your first job when you were babysitting, and then you went to work with the store that preceded Macy's.
I did babysitting. Well, you know, like I said, it was Buckhead, and you had all those wealthy white people, and it wasn't easy to even get their maids, you know, to come and be a babysitter. So this woman lived in my community, and she was one of their maids. Mm-hmm. So she asked me, would I like to be a babysitter? So their names were Dickies, and I've been planning to look them up all these years. And because since she was a little baby, she still may be alive since I was 14 or 15. And so anyway, I think I went through the house one night looking because of just being the baby there. And I saw where President Roosevelt had sent them one of these whole silver tea sets and things. Mm-hmm. So they were very wealthy people. And after that, because that was even during the school year, but during the summer, I applied for a job at Macy's, not at Macy's, but at Davidson. And I believe I made one mistake in that book, and that was that it was Richards, another department store, that became Macy's rather than Davidson. But that was a real treat for me because it allowed me to get clothes cheap. You know, every now and then they would have markdown clothes in the basement for the people who worked there that they could buy these clothes. And I was able to do that. And my job mostly was delivering packages downtown within walking distance. And usually it was at these offices of doctors and lawyers, and they would always tip me when I would bring the package over. So I really enjoyed that job that summer. And when I went to Spelman, I, you know, still wanted to wear pretty clothes. So it was easy for me to get an account at Davidson paying $15 a month for, you know, these unheard of calls. And that was about it with that experience in that store.
Was it then that you developed your fetish for hats?
Well, tell you the truth, I'm a Baptist.
Okay.
And, you know, every now and then, you know, I read the Bible. And when I was going to church in those days, all the women wore hats,
sure,
because
did.
Even the Catholics would have a little something on the top of their head, you know, to cover it. And the Bible said that women should wear their hair covered at mm-hmm. all times, you know, coming to church. And I've been following that all these years.
Yeah,
I love hats.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with the Honorable Harriet M. Murphy, the first permanent appointed African-American female judge in Texas, civil rights activist, college professor, and author of There All the Honor Lies. Dr. Murphy, I keep calling you Dr. Murphy, but Judge Murphy, when you were at Spelman, you were kind of pretty fly back then.
Yes, but I want to add something to what
okay.
you were saying about first, because I am the only black woman in Texas who has served as a presidential
sure.
elector for the Democratic Party.
Yes, yeah, sir.
And that was when Jimmy Carter became president. And I don't know why it was. I do know the woman who served as a presidential elector for the Republican Party, but that has not been done
since then. And yeah. when I read that in the book, I said, well, we had, you know, Barack Obama. And they didn't have a African-American female as an elector for his election. Yeah.
Well, I think it was because I was a government teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what the importance of a presidential elector
right.
is or has. So when I went to the state convention, I think in Austin they had, I'm not sure whether that was some kind of districts or what, but when I got to the state convention, I knew what I wanted to tell them that I wanted, you know, because
mm-hmm.
I'd worked very hard in the campaign, and I thought maybe I could get, you know, something that I asked for. And I said that I would like to consider running for a presidential elector for the Democratic Party. And I felt that those other people didn't know at that time how important
it was
that
right.
I did as mm-hmm. a teacher. And sure enough, they roll out the red carpet. You get invited to the inauguration. They roll out the red carpet. They have a big reception for all the electors.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a chance to have this seat I mentioned in the book, sitting behind Senator Warner of Virginia and his wife,
right.
Elizabeth Taylor, you know,
mm-hmm.
and she was just so gorgeous in her dress and everything. And I remember, I believe it was at the same time, I saw John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy walk behind there going, like they were going somewhere. And I thought I was able to get a picture of them, but I must not, I couldn't find it. I got so much junk, you know, I couldn't find it, you know.
When I was reading the book, I found it interesting that I said, this is not the Judge Murphy that I know. When you wanted to become a lawyer, but you put it on the back burner because your husband wanted, you know, a housewife. But eventually you did pursue becoming a lawyer. Why did you select the University of Texas to studies in law?
You know, that's a very interesting story to me, because there I was in Longview, Texas,
mm-hmm.
trying to get blacks registered to vote and everything, and especially getting close to when my husband died, there was just so many things to be done, like in 1964 when you had the Accommodation Act,
mm-hmm.
and I had to test it in Longview, couldn't get anybody to go with me to any restaurant to test it. It just so happened that there was a fellow from Longview who came. He was a principal somewhere, and he and his wife would come visit his mother. So she didn't mind going with me,
mm-hmm.
you know, because she felt the same way I did
mm-hmm.
about things. So anyway, I worked real hard with those Democratic fellows, white fellows, you know, trying to raise the percentage of blacks and all of that. And when it came time where I could possibly think about law school, I was discussing it, you know, with these fellows. And I didn't really know where I wanted to go, but it wasn't to the University of Texas because I had heard how discriminatory, mm-hmm. you know, the school was. But I even wrote to Texas Southern, and they never even responded.
They wrote you back, right.
And so finally, we were talking one day, and I said, I think I want to go to law school. And they said, well, the only law school you should go to is the University of Texas. They said, that is the school to go to, and especially if you want to come back up here in Longview to do anything, mm-hmm. achieve anything, you need a degree from the University of Texas. So that's where I applied, and I don't even know what my test score was. I just know I was accepted.
LSAT, right.
Yeah. And I came down here to talk to the dean, academic dean, to tell him that I couldn't come that spring semester. Could I come that summer? And he said, yes, you know, you could do that. And sometimes when I'm talking to Bill, I just don't know why I was accepted at the University of Texas. Since I don't remember what my score was, I do know that I made all A's at Atlanta University in political science, but I messed up as a college student. But then I thought about the fact that I took two correspondent courses in education,
right.
from the University of Texas that was under Kilgo College in that area, and I made A's in both of those courses. So I said, well, maybe they just think that if I could make A's in those courses, that I'll do all right in law school. But to my surprise, when I got there that summer, there were none of us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bert Christian was there,
yeah, right.
But that was the only one of us who was there, and that just really shocked me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going on to that car, I was a nervous wreck even while I was going. I had a heavy load teaching, which I shouldn't have.
I was going to ask you, but I said, how are you going? You're going to law school, and you're teaching us at Houston Tillerson.
Yeah, I was doing just that, and I know they stress the fact that you should not work over 20 hours outside mm-hmm. of law school because law is a very jealous mistress, they said.
Right, right.
But I needed the money, right. you know, mm-hmm. to pay for my apartment rent. And I enjoyed teaching. And in fact, I enjoyed that more. All I wanted to do was just pass the courses. I don't think I flunked in any, mm-hmm. but it was just passing the courses at UT in law school. So, yes, that was about it there, you know.
Fast forward to being appointed a judge here in Texas, first female judge in Texas. What was that day like?
Well, I don't know. I thought it was just kind of an ordinary day, you know. I didn't know that I stood out like that, but I got some calls from Dallas. It had come out on the radio, you know. And these people were calling me, congratulating me. And then I realized, you know, the importance of it, because I had no idea, you know, about who was judge and who was not judge. But like I said in that book, I was kind of a nervous wreck going to UT because blacks here in Austin kept telling me I was not going to graduate. And then when I graduated, I was not going to pass the bar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it through.
Going back to Houston Tillerson, you founded a program that exposed some of my classmates and then others down the road of what the law profession was really all about. Tell us about that program.
Well, I really enjoyed the Pre-Law Society.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the main focus was to get these students who said that they were interested in law to do as much as I could to head them toward law school. And I can't think, it's a pretty well-known program that pre-law students can go to. And also, I'm not sure whether they had to take a test to go there to be accepted, because I remember telling them that so many of the Jews were able to go because they would go to the library and they would read all those books about, about law school and what to expect. And that they had to do the same thing, you know, if that's what they wanted. So anyway, one of the events, and I don't think I even mentioned it in the book, the dean of the law school at Baylor invited us up one Saturday to spend the day there on their campus with some of their law students present. And they provided a boat ride for us in Waco. Mm-hmm. And also we had, because it was only about 8 or 9 of us students, and we had dinner at the dean's house, and I was surprised that they were trying to have what they thought we would like. They had a grit casserole. They had heard that the blacks like grits, you know. So I said, I really said to myself, thank you for being aware, you know, or trying to please us with what they thought that we would enjoy. And it was grits and cheese, some kind of grit casserole. But we were not ever invited to UT to anything, you know, like that. So it was just a matter of trying to get students to register for UT and to try to get them into UT if it was any way possible, and to register for some other schools. Uh-huh. I think with those Fleming boys, I think one went to Texas Southern and right. one went to Emory. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're correct.
But they were very smart young men.
Yes.
And then there was Stan Kerr. Now, the professor at UT Law School, who was supposed to be trying to encourage minority students, but he really didn't think any of us were good, had the ability to come,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
from Houston Tillotson, from
right.
that college, you know. But here comes Stan Kerr, and he seemed to have topped the score when they looked at his record and he registered. The man called me, the professor, I should never forget the day he called me. He said, "Is this Stan Kerr who applied to UT Law School from Houston Tillotson? Is he black or is he white? What color is he?"
The Honorable Dr. Harriet M. Murphy, retired municipal court judge, civil rights activist, former college dean, and author of "There All There Aren't Lies," a memoir. We will conclude our conversation on next week's program. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny Johansson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.